Mason's face. I immediately went on the defensive, jerking backward and peering around. Whoops and cries sounded from an area of the resort grounds that held storage sheds and was interspersed with looming pines.
"Too slow, Ashford,"
someone called.
"Doesn't pay to be in love."
More laughs. Mason's best friend, Eddie Castile, and a few other novices from school materialized from behind a cluster of trees. Beyond them, I heard more shouts.
"We'll still take you in, though, if you want to be on our team," said Eddie. "Even if you do dodge like a girl."
"Team?" I asked, excitedly. Back at the academy, throwing snowballs was strictly prohibited. School officials were inexplicably afraid that we'd throw snowballs packed with glass shards or razor blades, though I had no clue how they thought we'd get a hold of that kind of stuff in the first place. Not that a snowball fight was that rebellious, but after all the stress I'd been through recently, throwing objects at other people suddenly sounded like the best idea I'd heard in a while. Mason and I dashed off with the others, the prospect of forbidden fighting giving him new energy and causing him to forget the pain in his ankle. We set to the fight with a die-hard zeal. The fight soon became a matter of nailing as many people as possible while dodging attacks from others. I was exceptional at both, and furthered the immaturity by catcalling and shouting silly insults at my victims. By the time someone noticed what we were doing and yelled at us, we were all laughing and covered with snow. Mason and I once again started back for the lodge, and our mood was so high, I knew the Adrian thing was long forgotten. Indeed, Mason looked at me just before we went inside.
"Sorry, I jumped all over you about Adrian earlier."
I squeezed his hand. "It's okay. I know Maya can tell some pretty convincing stories."
"Yeah, but even if you were with him, it's not like I have any right."
I stared at him, surprised to see his usual brash countenance turn shy. "Don't you?" I asked. A smile turned up his lips.
"Do I?"
Smiling back, I stepped forward and kissed him. His lips felt amazingly warm in the freezing air. It wasn't like the earth-shattering kiss I'd had with Dimitri before the trip, but it was sweet and nice. A friendly sort of kiss that maybe could turn into more. At least, that was how I saw it. From the look on Mason's face, it appeared his whole world had been rocked.
"Wow,"
he said, eyes wide. The moonlight made his eyes look silvery blue. "You see?" I said. "Nothing to worry about. Not Adrian. Not anybody." We kissed again, a bit longer this time, before finally dragging ourselves apart. Mason was clearly in a better mood, as well as he should have been, and I dropped into bed with a smile on my face. I wasn't technically sure if Mason and I were a couple now, but we were very close to it. But when I slept, I dreamed about Adrian Ivashkov. I stood with him on the porch again, only it was summer. The air was balmy and warm, and the sun hung bright in the sky, coating everything in golden light. I hadn't been in this much sun since living among humans. All around, the mountains and valleys were green and alive. Birds sang everywhere. Adrian leaned against the porch's railing, glanced over, and did a double take when he saw me.
"Oh, didn't expect to see you here,"
he smiled.
"I was right. You are devastating when you're cleaned up."
Instinctively, I touched the skin around my eye.
"It's gone," he said.
Even without being able to see it, I somehow knew he was right. "You aren't smoking."
"Bad habit," he said.
He nodded toward me.
"You scared? You're wearing a lot of protection."
I frowned, then looked down. I hadn't noticed my clothing. I wore a pair of embroidered jeans I'd seen once but had been unable to afford. My T-shirt was cropped, showing off my stomach, and I wore a belly button ring. I'd always wanted to get my belly button pierced, but I had never been able to afford it. The charm I now wore here was a little silver dangly one, and hanging at the end of it was that weird blue eye pendant my mom had given me. Lissa's tchotchke was wound around my wrist.
I looked back up at Adrian, studying the way the sun shone off his brown hair. Here, in full daylight, I could see that his eyes were indeed green, a deep emerald as opposed to Lissa's pale jade. Something startling suddenly occurred to me.
Doesn't all this sun bother you?
He gave a lazy shrug.
Nah, it's my dream.
No, it's my dream.
Are you sure?
His smile returned.
I felt confused.
I don't know.
He chuckled, but a moment later the laughter faded. For the first time since I'd met him, he looked serious.
Why do you have so much darkness around you?
I frowned.
What?
You're surrounded in blackness.
His eyes studied me shrewdly, but not in a checking me out sort of way.
I've never seen anyone like you. Shadows everywhere. I never would have guessed it. Even while you're standing here, the shadows keep growing.
I looked down at my hands but saw nothing out of the ordinary. I glanced back up. I'm shadow-kissed.
What's that mean?
I died once. I'd never talked to anyone other than Lissa and Viktor Doshkov about that, but this was a dream. It didn't matter. And I came back. Wonder lit his face.
Ah, interesting.
I woke up. Someone was shaking me. It was Lissa. Her feelings hit me so hard through the bond that I briefly snapped into her mind and found myself looking at me. Weird didn't begin to cover it. I pulled back into myself, trying to sift through the terror and alarm coming from her.
What's wrong? There's been another Strigoi attack.
Chapter 12. I was out of bed in a flash. We found the entire lodge abuzz with the news. People clustered in small groups in the halls. Family members sought each other out. Some conversations were conducted in terrified whispers. Some were loud and easy to overhear. I stopped a few people, trying to get the story straight. Everyone had a different version of what had happened, though, and some wouldn't even pause to talk. They hurried past, either seeking out loved ones or preparing to leave the resort, convinced there might be a safer place elsewhere. Frustrated with the differing stories, I finally, reluctantly, knew I had to seek out one of the two sources who would give me solid information. My mother or Dmitri. It was like flipping a coin. I wasn't really thrilled with either one of them right now. I debated momentarily and finally decided on my mother, seeing as how she wasn't getting it on with Tasha Ozera. The door to my mother's room was ajar, and as Lissa and I entered, I saw that a sort of makeshift headquarters had been established here. Lots of guardians were milling around, moving in and out, and discussing strategy. A few gave us odd looks, but no one stopped or questioned us. Lissa and I slid onto a small sofa to listen to a conversation my mother was having. She stood with a group of guardians, one of whom was Dmitri. So much for avoiding him. His brown eyes glanced at me briefly, and I averted my gaze. I didn't want to deal with my troubled feelings for him right now. Lissa and I soon discerned the details. 8 Moroi had been killed along with their 5 guardians. 3 Moroi were still missing, either dead or turned Strigoi. The attack hadn't really happened near here. It had been somewhere in Northern California. Nonetheless, a tragedy like this couldn't help but reverberate within the Moroi world, and for some, 2 states away was far too close. People were terrified, and I soon learned what in particular made this attack so notable.
"There had to be more than last time," said my mother.
"More?" exclaimed one of the other guardians. "That last group was unheard of. I still can't believe 9 Strigoi managed to work together. You expect me to believe they managed to get more organized still?"
"Yes," snapped my mother.
"Any evidence of humans?"
someone else asked. My mother hesitated, then,
"Yes, more broken wards. And the way it was all conducted, it's identical to the Badika attack."
Her voice was hard, but there was a kind of weariness in it, too. It wasn't physical exhaustion, though. It was mental, I realized. Strain and hurt over what they were talking about.
I always thought of my mother as some sort of unfeeling killing machine, but this was clearly hard for her. It was a hard, ugly matter to discuss, but at the same time, she was tackling it without hesitation. It was her duty. A lump formed in my throat that I quickly swallowed down. Humans, identical to the Badika attack. Ever since that massacre, we'd extensively analyzed the oddity of such a large group of Strigoi teaming up and recruiting humans. We'd spoken in vague terms about if something like this ever happens again. But no one had seriously talked about this group, the Badika killers, doing it again. One time was a fluke. Maybe a bunch of Strigoi had happened to gather and impulsively decided to go on a raid. It was horrible, but we could write that off. But now? Now it looked as though that group of Strigoi hadn't been a random occurrence. They'd united with purpose, utilizing humans strategically, and had attacked again. We now had what could be a pattern. Strigoi actively seeking out large groups of prey. Serial killings. We could no longer trust the protective magic of the wards. We couldn't even trust sunlight. Humans could move around in the day, scouting and sabotaging. The light was no longer safe. I remembered what I'd said to Dimitri at the Badika house. This changes everything, doesn't it? My mother flipped through some papers on a clipboard. They don't have forensic details yet, but the same number of Strigoi couldn't have done this. None of the Drozdovs or their staff escaped. With 5 Guardians, 7 Strigoi would have been preoccupied, at least temporarily, for some to escape. We're looking at 9 or 10, maybe. Janine's right, said Dimitri. And if you look at the venue, it's too big. 7 couldn't have covered it. The Drozdovs were one of the 12 royal families. They were large and prosperous, not like Lys's dying clan. They had plenty of family members to go around, but obviously an attack like this was still horrible. Furthermore, something about them tickled my brain. There was something I should remember, something I should know about the Drozdovs. While part of my mind puzzled that out, I watched my mother with fascination. I'd listened to her tell her stories. I'd seen and felt her fight. But really, truly, I'd never seen her in action in a real-life crisis. She showed every bit of that hard control she did around me, but here, I could see how necessary it was. A situation like this created panic, even among the Guardians. I could sense those who were so keyed up they wanted to do something drastic. My mother was a voice of reason, a reminder that they had to stay focused and fully assess the situation. Her composure calmed everybody. Her strong manner inspired them. This, I realized, was how a leader behaved. Dimitri was just as collected as she was, but he deferred to her to run things. I had to remind myself sometimes that he was young as far as Guardians went. They discussed the attack more, how the Drozdovs had been having a belated Christmas party in a banquet hall when they were attacked. First Badikas, now Drozdovs, muttered one Guardian.
They're going after royals.
They're going after Maroi, said Dimitri flatly.
Royal, non-royal, it doesn't matter.
Royal, non-royal? I suddenly knew why the Drozdovs were important. My spontaneous instincts wanted me to jump up and ask a question right now, but I knew better. This was the real deal. This was no time for irrational behavior. I wanted to be as strong as my mother and Dimitri, so I waited for the discussion to end. When the group started to break up, I leapt up off the sofa and pushed my way toward my mother.
Rose, she said, surprised. Like in Stan's class, she hadn't noticed me in the room.
What are you doing here?
It was such a stupid question, I didn't try to answer it. What did she think I was doing here? This was one of the biggest things to happen to the Maroi. I pointed to her clipboard. Who else was killed? Irritation wrinkled her forehead.
Drozdovs.
But who else?
Rose, we don't have time.
They had staff, right? Dimitri said non-royals.
Who were they?
Again, I saw the weariness in her. She took these deaths hard.
I don't know all the names.
Flipping through a few pages, she turned the clipboard toward me.
There.
I scanned the list. My heart sank.
Okay, I told her. Thanks.
Lissa and I left them to go about their business. I wished I could have helped, but the guardians ran smoothly and efficiently on their own. They had no need for novices underfoot.
What was that about? Asked Lissa, once we were heading back to the main part of the lodge.
The Drozdov staff, I said. Maya's mom worked for them. Lissa gasped.
And?
I sighed.
And her name was on the list.
Oh, God. Lissa stopped walking. She stared off into space, blinking back tears.
Oh, God, she repeated.
I moved in front of her and placed my hands on her shoulders. She was shaking.
It's okay, I said.
Her fear came to me in waves, but it was a numbed fear. Shock.
This is going to be okay. You heard them, she said. There's a band of Strigoi organizing and attacking us. How many? Are they coming here?
No, I said firmly. I had no evidence of that, of course. We're safe here.
Poor Maya.
There was nothing I could say to that. I thought Maya was an absolute bitch, but I wouldn't wish this on anyone, not even my worst enemy. Which, technically, she was. Immediately, I corrected that thought. Maya wasn't my worst enemy. I couldn't bear to leave Lissa's side for the rest of the day. I knew there were no Strigoi lurking in the lodge, but my protective instincts ran too strong. Guardians protected their Maroi. Like usual, I also worried about her being anxious and upset, so I did my best to diffuse those feelings. The other guardians provided reassurance for Maroi, too. They didn't walk side by side with Maroi, but they reinforced lodge security and stayed in constant communication with guardians at the scene of the attack. Information flowed in all day about the grisly specifics, as well as speculation about where the band of Strigoi was. Little of this was shared with novices, of course. While the guardians did what they did best, the Maroi also did what they, unfortunately, did best. Talk. With so many royals and other important Maroi at the lodge, a meeting was organized that night to discuss what had happened and what might be done in the future. Nothing official would be decided here. The Maroi had a queen and a governing council elsewhere for those types of decisions. Everyone knew, though, that opinions gathered here would make their way up the chain of command. Our future safety could very well depend on what was discussed in this meeting. It was held in an enormous banquet hall inside the lodge, one with a podium and plenty of seating. Despite the businesslike atmosphere, you could tell this room had been designed for things other than meetings about massacres and defense. The carpet had the texture of velvet and showed an ornate floral design in shades of silver and black. The chairs were made of black polished wood and had high backs, clearly intended for fancy dining. Paintings of long-dead Maroi royalty hung on the walls. I stared briefly at one of a queen whose name I didn't know. She wore an old-fashioned dress, too heavy on lace for my tastes, and had pale hair like Lissa's. Some guy I didn't know was in charge of moderating and stood at the podium. Most of the royals on hand gathered at the front of the room. Everyone else, including students, took seats wherever they could. Christian and Mason had found Lissa and me by that point, and we all started to sit in the back when Lissa suddenly shook her head.
I'm going to sit in the front.
The three of us stared at her. I was too dumbfounded to probe her mind.
Look, she pointed.
The royals are sitting up there, sitting by family. It was true. Members of the same clans had clustered near each other. Badikas,
Ivashkovs, Zelkloses, etc. Tasha sat there as well, but she was by herself. Christian was the only other Ozera there.
I need to be up there, said Lissa.
No one expects you to be there, I told her.
I have to represent the Dragomirs.
Christian scoffed. It's all a bunch of royal bullshit.
Her face set into a determined expression. I need to be up there.
I opened myself up to Lissa's feelings and liked what I found. She'd spent most of the day quiet and afraid, much as she had when we'd found out about Maya's mom. That fear was within her still, but it was overpowered by a steady confidence and determination. She recognized that she was one of the ruling Moroi, and as much as the idea of roving bands of Strigoi scared her, she wanted to do her part.
You should do it, I said softly.
I also liked the idea of her defying Christian. Lissa met my eyes and smiled. She knew what I had sensed. A moment later, she turned to Christian.
You should join your aunt.
Christian opened his mouth to protest. If not for the horribleness of the situation, seeing Lissa order him around would have been funny. He was always stubborn and difficult. Those who tried to push him didn't succeed. Watching his face, I saw the same realization I'd had about Lissa come over him. He liked seeing her strong, too. He pressed his lips together in a grimace.
Okay.
He caught her hand, and the two of them walked off toward the front. Mason and I sat down. Just before things started, Dimitri sat on the other side of me, hair tied behind his neck and the leather coat draping around him as he settled in the chair. I glanced at him in surprise, but said nothing. There were few guardians at this gathering. Most were too busy doing damage control. It would figure. There I was, stuck between both of my men. The meeting kicked off shortly thereafter. Everyone was eager to talk about how they thought the Moroi should be saved, but really, two theories got the most attention.
The answer's all around us, said one royal.
Once he'd been given leave to speak, he stood by his chair and looked around the room.
Here, in places like this lodge and St. Vladimir's, we send our children to safe places, places where they have safety in numbers and can be easily guarded. And look how many of us made it here, children and adults alike. Why don't we live this way all the time?
Plenty of us already do, someone shouted back.
The man waved that off.
A couple of families here and there, or a town with a large Moroi population. But those Moroi are still decentralized. Most don't pool their resources, their guardians, their magic. If we could emulate this model,
he spread his hands out,
we'd never have to worry about Strigoi again.
And Moroi could never interact with the rest of the world again, I muttered. Well, until humans discovered secret vampire cities sprouting up in the wilderness, then we'd have lots of interactions.
The other theory about how to protect the Moroi involved fewer logistical problems but had greater personal impact, particularly for me.
The problem is simply that we don't have enough guardians. This plan's advocate was some woman from the Seltsky clan. And so, the answer is simple. Get more. The Drozdovs had 5 guardians, and that wasn't enough. Only 6 to protect over 12 Moroi? That's unacceptable. It's no wonder these kinds of things keep happening.
Where do you propose getting more guardians from?
Asked the man who'd been in favor of Moroi banding together.
They're kind of a limited resource.
She pointed to where I and a few other novices sat. We've got plenty already. I've watched them train. They're deadly. Why are we waiting until they turn 18? If we accelerated the training program and focused more on combat training than bookwork, we could turn out new guardians when they're 16. Dimitri made a sound low in his throat that didn't seem happy. Leaning forward, he placed his elbows on his knees and rested his chin in his hands, eyes narrowed in thought.
Not only that, we have plenty of potential guardians going to waste. Where are all the Dampir women? Our races are intertwined. The Moroi are doing their part to help the Dampir survive. Why aren't these women doing theirs? Why aren't they here?
A long, sultry laugh came as an answer. All eyes turned toward Tasha Ozera. Whereas many of the other royals had dressed up, she was easy and casual. She wore her usual jeans, a white tank top that showed a bit of midriff, and a blue, lacy knit cardigan that came to her knees. Glancing at the moderator, she asked,
"May I?"
He nodded. The Seltsky woman sat down. Tasha stood up. Unlike the other speakers, she strode right up to the podium so she could be clearly seen by everyone. Her glossy black hair was pulled back into a ponytail, completely exposing her scars in a way I suspected was intentional. Her face was bold and defiant. Beautiful.
"Those women aren't here, Monica, because they're too busy raising their children. You know, the ones you want to start sending out to the fronts as soon as they can walk. And please, don't insult us by acting like the Moroi do a huge favor to the Dampirs by helping them reproduce. Maybe it's different in your family, but for the rest of us, sex is fun. The Moroi doing it with Dampirs aren't really making that big of a sacrifice."
Dimitri had straightened up now, his expression no longer angry. Probably he was excited that his new girlfriend had mentioned sex. Irritation shot through me, and I hoped that if I had a homicidal look on my face, people would assume it was for Strigoi and not the woman currently addressing us. Beyond Dimitri, I suddenly noticed Maya sitting by herself, farther down the row. I hadn't realized she was here. She was slumped in her seat. Her eyes were red-rimmed, her face paler than usual. A funny ache burned in my chest, one I'd never expected her to bring out.
"And the reason we're waiting for these guardians to turn 18 is so that we can allow them to enjoy some pretense of a life before forcing them to spend the rest of their days in constant danger. They need those extra years to develop mentally as well as physically. Pull them out before they're ready, treat them like they're parts on an assembly line, and you're just creating Strigoi fodder."
A few people gasped at Tasha's callous choice of words, but she succeeded in getting everyone's attention.
"You create more fodder still if you try making the other Dampir women become guardians. You can't force them into that life if they don't want it. This entire plan of yours to get more guardians relies on throwing children and the unwilling into harm's way just so you can barely stay one step ahead of the enemy. I would have said it's the stupidest plan I've ever heard if I hadn't already had to listen to his."
She pointed to the first speaker, the one who had wanted Moroi compounds. Embarrassment clouded his features.
"Enlighten us then, Natasha," he said. "Tell us what you think we should do, seeing as you have so much experience with Strigoi."
A thin smile played on Tasha's lips, but she didn't rise to the insult.
"What do I think?"
She strode closer to the stage's front, gazing at us as she answered his question.
"I think we should stop coming up with plans that involve us relying on someone or something to protect us. You think there are too few guardians? That's not the problem. The problem is that there are too many Strigoi, and we've let them multiply and become more powerful because we do nothing about them except have stupid arguments like this. We run and hide behind the Dampirs and let the Strigoi go unchecked. It's our fault. We are the reason those Drozdovs died. You want an army? Well, here we are. Dampirs aren't the only ones who can learn to fight. The question, Monica, isn't where the Dampir women are in this fight. The question is, where are we?"
Tasha was shouting by now, and the exertion turned her cheeks pink. Her eyes shone in her impassioned feelings, and when combined with the rest of her pretty features, and even with the scar, she made a striking figure.
Most people couldn't take their eyes off her. Lissa watched Tasha with wonder, inspired by her words. Mason looked hypnotized. Dimitri looked impressed. And farther past him. Farther past him was Maya. Maya, no longer hunched in her chair. She was sitting up straight. Straight as a stick. Her eyes as wide as they could go. She stared at Tasha as though she alone held all the answers to life. Monica Seltsky looked less awed, and she fixed her gaze on Tasha.
Surely you aren't suggesting the Moroi fight alongside the Guardians when the Strigoi come.
Tasha regarded her levelly.
No. I'm suggesting the Moroi and the Guardians go fight the Strigoi before they come.
A guy in his 20s who looked like a Ralph Lauren spokesmodel shot up. I would have wagered money he was a royal. No one else could have afforded blonde highlights that perfect. He untied an expensive sweater from around his waist and draped it over the back of his chair.
Oh,
he said in a mocking voice, speaking out of turn.
So you're going to just give us clubs and stakes and send us off to do battle?
Tasha shrugged.
If that's what it takes, Andrew, then sure.
A sly smile crossed her pretty lips.
But there are other weapons we can learn to use, too. Ones the Guardians can't.
The look on his face showed how insane he thought the idea was. He rolled his eyes.
Oh, yeah? Like what?
Her smile turned into a full-fledged grin.
Like this.
She waved her hand, and the sweater he'd placed on the back of his chair burst into flames. He yelped in surprise and knocked it to the floor, stamping it out with his feet. There was a brief collective intake of breath throughout the room, and then chaos broke out. Chapter 13. People stood up and shouted, everyone wanting their opinion to be heard. As it was, most of them held the same view. Tasha was wrong. They told her she was crazy. They told her that in sending out Moroi and Dampiers to fight the Strigoi, she'd be expediting the extinction of both races. They even had the nerve to suggest that that was Tasha's plan all along, that she was somehow collaborating with the Strigoi in all of this. Dimitri stood up, disgust all over his features as he surveyed the chaos.
You might as well leave. Nothing useful's going to happen now.
Mason and I rose, but he shook his head when I started to follow Dimitri out.
You go on, said Mason. I want to check something out.
I glanced at the standing, arguing people. I shrugged.
Good luck.
I couldn't believe it had only been a few days since I'd spoken to Dimitri. Stepping out into the hall with him, I felt like it'd been years. Being with Mason these last couple of days had been fantastic, but seeing Dimitri again, all of my old feelings for him came rushing back. Suddenly, Mason seemed like a child. My distress over the Tasha situation also came back, and stupid words fell out of my mouth before I could stop them. "Shouldn't you be in there protecting Tasha?" I asked. "Before the mob gets her? She's going to get in big trouble for using magic like that." He raised an eyebrow.
"She can take care of herself."
"Yeah, yeah, because she's a badass karate magic user. I get all that. I just figured since you're going to be her guardian and all."
"Where did you hear that?"
"I have my sources." Somehow, saying I'd heard it from my mom sounded less cool. "You've decided to, right? I mean, it sounds like a good deal, seeing as she's going to give you fringe benefits." He gave me a level look.
"What happens between her and me is none of your business," he replied crisply.
The words, "between her and me," stung. It sounded like he and Tasha were a done deal. And, as often happened when I was hurt, my temper and attitude took over. "Well, I'm sure you guys will be happy together. She's just your type, too.
I know how much you like women who aren't your own age. I mean, she's what, 6 years older than you? 7? And I'm 7 years younger than you.
Yes, he said after several moments of silence. You are. And every second this conversation goes on, you only prove how young you really are.
Whoa, my jaw almost hit the floor. Not even my mother punching me had hurt as badly as that. For a heartbeat, I thought I saw regret in his eyes, like he too realized just how harsh his words had been. But the moment passed, and his expression was hard once more.
Little Dompier?
A voice suddenly said nearby. Slowly, still stunned, I turned toward Adrian Ivashkov. He grinned at me and gave a brief nod of acknowledgement to Dmitri. I suspected my face was bright red. How much had Adrian heard? He held up his hands in a casual gesture.
I don't want to interrupt or anything. Just wanted to talk to you when you have time.
I wanted to tell Adrian I didn't have time to play whatever game he was into now, but Dmitri's words still smarted. He was looking at Adrian now in a very disapproving way. I suspected he, like everyone else, had heard about Adrian's bad reputation. Good, I thought. I suddenly wanted him to be jealous. I wanted to hurt him as much as he'd hurt me lately. Swallowing my pain, I unearthed my man-eating smile, one I hadn't used to full effect in some time. I walked over to Adrian and put a hand on his arm. I've got time now. I gave a nod of my own to Dmitri and steered Adrian away, walking close to him. See you later, Guardian Belikov. Dmitri's dark eyes followed us stonily. Then I turned away and didn't look back.
Not into older guys, huh?
Asked Adrian once we were alone. You're imagining things, I said. Clearly, my stunning beauty has clouded your mind. He laughed that nice laugh of his.
That's entirely possible.
I started to step back, but he tossed an arm around me.
No, no. You wanted to play chummy with me. Now you've got to see it through.
I rolled my eyes at him and let the arm stay. I could smell alcohol on him as well as the perpetual smell of cloves. I wondered if he was drunk now. I had the feeling that there was probably little difference between his attitudes, drunk or sober. What do you want? I asked. He studied me for a moment.
I want you to grab Vasilisa and come with me. We're going to have some fun. You'll probably want a swimsuit, too.
He seemed disappointed by the admission of this.
Unless you want to go naked.
What? A bunch of Maroi and Dompiers just got slaughtered, and you want to go swimming and have fun?
It's not just swimming, he said patiently. Besides, that slaughter is exactly why you should go do this.
Before I could argue that, I saw my friends round the corner. Lissa, Mason, and Christian. Eddie Castile was with the group, which shouldn't have surprised me, but Maya was as well, which certainly did surprise me. They were deep in conversation, though they all stopped talking when they saw me.
There you are, said Lissa, a puzzled look on her face.
I remembered Adrian's arm was still around me. I stepped out of it. Hey, guys, I said. A moment of awkwardness hung around us, and I was pretty sure I heard a low chuckle from Adrian. I beamed at him and then my friends. Adrian invited us to go swimming. They stared at me in surprise, and I could almost see the wheels of speculation turning in their heads. Mason's face darkened a little, but like the others, he said nothing. I stifled a groan. Adrian took me inviting the others to his secret interlude pretty well. With his easygoing attitude, I hadn't really expected anything else. Once we had swimsuits, we followed his directions to a doorway in one of the far wings of the lodge. It held a staircase that led down and down and down.
I nearly got dizzy as we wound around and around. Electric lights hung in the walls, but as we went farther, the painted walls changed to carved stone. When we reached our destination, we discovered Adrian had been right. It wasn't just swimming. We were in a special spa area of the resort, one used only for the most elite Moroi. In this case, it was reserved for a bunch of royals I assumed were Adrian's friends. There were about 30 others, all his age or older, who bore the marks of wealth and elitism. The spa consisted of a series of hot mineral pools. Maybe once they'd been in a cave or something, but the lodge builders had long since gotten rid of any sort of rustic surroundings. The black stone walls and ceiling were as polished and beautiful as anything else in the resort. It was like being in a cave, a really nice designer cave. Racks of towels lined the walls, as did tables full of exotic food. The baths matched the rest of the room's hewn-out decor. Stone-lined pools containing hot water that was heated from some underground source. Steam filled the room, and a faint metallic smell hung in the air. Sounds of partygoers laughing and splashing echoed around us. "Why is Mia with you?" I asked Lissa softly. We were winding our way through the room, looking for a pool that wasn't occupied. "She was talking to Mason when we were getting ready to leave," she returned. She kept her voice just as quiet. It seemed mean to just, I don't know, leave her. Even I agreed with that. Obvious signs of grief were written all over her face. But Maya seemed at least momentarily distracted by whatever Mason was telling her. I thought you didn't know Adrian, Lissa added. Disapproval hung in her voice and in the bond. We finally found a large pool, a little out of the way. A guy and a girl were on the opposite side, all over each other, but there was plenty of room for the rest of us. They were easy to ignore. I put a foot into the water and pulled it back immediately. "I don't," I told her. Cautiously, I inched the foot back in, slowly followed by the rest of my body. When I got to my stomach, I grimaced. I had on a maroon bikini, and the scalding water caught my stomach by surprise. "You must know him a little. He invited you to a party." "Yeah, but do you see him with us now?" She followed my gaze. Adrian stood on the far side of the room with a group of girls in bikinis much smaller than mine. One was a Betsy Johnson suit I'd seen in a magazine and coveted. I sighed and looked away. We'd all slipped into the water by then. It was so hot I felt like I was in a soup kettle. Now that Lissa seemed convinced of my innocence with Adrian, I tuned in to the others' discussion. "What are you talking about?" I interrupted. It was easier than listening and figuring it out myself.
"The meeting," said Mason excitedly.
Apparently, he'd gotten over seeing me and Adrian together. Christian had settled onto a small shelf in the pool. Lissa curled up beside him. Putting a proprietary arm around her, he tipped his back so it rested on the edge.
"Your boyfriend wants to lead an army against the Strigoi," he told me. I could tell he was saying it to provoke me.
I looked at Mason questioningly. It wasn't worth the effort to challenge the boyfriend comment.
"Hey, it was your aunt who suggested it," Mason reminded Christian. "She only said we should find the Strigoi before they find us again," countered Christian. "She wasn't pushing for novice fighting. That was Monica Seltsky."
A waitress came by then with a tray of pink drinks. These were in elegant, long-stemmed crystal glasses with sugared rims. I had a strong suspicion the drinks were alcoholic, but I doubted anyone who made it into this party was going to get carded. I had no idea what they were. Most of my experiences with alcohol had involved cheap beer. I took a glass and turned back to Mason.
You think that's a good idea?
I asked him. I sipped the drink, cautiously. As a guardian in training, I felt like I should always be on alert. But tonight, I once again felt like being rebellious. The drink tasted like punch. Grapefruit juice. Something sweet, like strawberries. I was still pretty sure there was alcohol in it, but it didn't appear strong enough for me to lose sleep over. Another waitress soon appeared with a tray of food. I eyed it and recognized almost nothing. There was something that looked vaguely like mushrooms stuffed with cheese, as well as something else that looked like little round patties of meat or sausage. As a good carnivore, I reached for one, thinking it couldn't be that bad.
"It's foie gras," said Christian. There was a smile on his face I didn't like. I eyed him warily.
"What's that?"
"You don't know?"
His tone was cocky, and for once in his life, he sounded like a true royal touting his elite knowledge over us underlings. He shrugged.
"Take a chance. Find out."
Lissa sighed in exasperation. "It's goose liver."
I jerked my hand back. The waitress moved on, and Christian laughed. I glared at him.
Meanwhile, Mason was still hung up on my question about whether novices going to battle before graduation was a good idea.
"What else are we doing?"
he asked indignantly.
"What are you doing? You run laps with Belikov every morning. What's that doing for you? For the Maroi?"
What was that doing for me? Making my heart race and my mind have indecent thoughts.
"We aren't ready," I said instead. "We've only got 6 more months,"
piped in Eddie. Mason nodded his agreement.
"Yeah, how much more can we learn?"
"Plenty," I said, thinking of how much I'd picked up from my tutoring sessions with Dimitri. I finished my drink. "Besides, where does it stop? Let's say they end school 6 months early, then send us off. What next? They decide to push back further and cut our senior year? Our junior year?" He shrugged.
"I'm not afraid to fight. I could have taken on Strogoi when I was a sophomore."
"Yeah," I said dryly. "Just like you did skiing on that slope." Mason's face, already flushed from the heat, turned redder still. I immediately regretted my words, particularly when Christian started laughing.
"Never thought I'd live to see the day when I agreed with you, Rose, but sadly, I do."
The cocktail waitress came by again, and both Christian and I took new drinks.
"The Maroi have got to start helping us defend themselves."
"With magic?" asked Maya suddenly. It was the first time she'd spoken since we'd got here. Silence met her. I think Mason and Eddie didn't respond because they knew nothing about fighting with magic. Lissa, Christian, and I did, and we were trying very hard to act like we didn't. There was a funny sort of hope in Maya's eyes, though, and I could only imagine what she'd gone through today. She'd woken up to learn her mother was dead, and then had been subjected to hours and hours of political bantering and battle strategies. The fact that she was sitting here at all, seeming semi-composed, was a miracle. I assumed people who actually liked their mothers would barely be able to function in that situation. When no one else looked like they were going to answer her, I finally said, "I suppose, but I don't know much about that." I finished the rest of my drink and averted my eyes, hoping someone else would take up the conversation. They didn't. Maya looked disappointed, but said no more when Mason switched back to the Strogoi debate. I took a third drink and sank into the water as far as I reasonably could and still hold the glass. This drink was different. It looked chocolatey and had whipped cream on top. I took a taste and definitely detected the bite of alcohol. Still, I figured the chocolate probably diluted it. When I was ready for a fourth drink, the waitress was nowhere in sight.
Mason seemed really, really cute to me all of a sudden. I would have liked a little romantic attention from him, but he was still going on about Strigoi and the logistics of leading a strike in the middle of the day. Maya and Eddie were nodding along with him eagerly, and I got the feeling that if he decided to hunt Strigoi right now, they'd follow. Christian was actually joining the talk, but it was more to play devil's advocate. Typical. He thought a sort of preemptive strike would require guardians and Maroi, much as Tasha had said. Mason, Maya, and Eddie argued that if the Maroi weren't up to it, the guardians should take matters into their own hands. I confess, their enthusiasm was kind of contagious. I rather liked the idea of getting the drop on Strigoi. But in the Badika and Drozdov attacks, all the guardians had been killed. Admittedly, the Strigoi had organized into huge groups and had help, but all that told me was that our side needed to be extra careful. His cuteness aside, I didn't want to listen to Mason talk about his battle skills anymore. I wanted another drink. I stood up and climbed over the edge of the pool. To my astonishment, the world started spinning. I'd had that happen before when I got out of baths or hot tubs too quickly, but when things didn't right themselves, I realized those drinks might have been stronger than I thought. I also decided a fourth wasn't such a good idea, but I didn't want to get back in and let everyone know I was drunk. I headed off toward a side room I'd seen the waitress disappear into. I hoped maybe there was a secret stash of dessert somewhere. Chocolate mousse instead of goose liver. As I walked, I paid special attention to the slippery floor, thinking that falling into one of the pools and cracking my skull would definitely cost me coolness points. I was paying so much attention to my feet and trying not to stagger that I walked into someone. To my credit, it'd been his fault. He'd backed into me. "Hey, watch it," I said, steadying myself. But he wasn't paying attention to me. His eyes were on another guy. A guy with a bloody nose. I'd walked right into the middle of a fight. Chapter 14. Two guys I'd never met before were squaring off against each other. They looked to be in their 20s, and neither noticed me. The one who'd bumped into me shoved the other one hard, forcing him to stagger back considerably. "You're afraid," yelled the guy by me. He had on green swimming trunks, and his black hair was slicked back with water. "You're all afraid. You just want to hole up in your mansions and let the guardians do your dirty work. What are you going to do when they're all dead? Who will protect you then?" The other guy wiped the blood off his face with the back of his hand. I suddenly recognized him, thanks to his blonde highlights. He was the royal who'd yelled at Tasha about wanting to lead Maroi into battle. She'd called him Andrew. He tried to land a hit and failed. His technique was all wrong. "This is the safest way. Listen to that Strigoi lover, and we'll all be dead. She's trying to kill our whole race off. She's trying to save us. She's trying to get us to use black magic." The Strigoi lover had to be Tasha. The non-royal guy was the first person outside of my little circle whom I'd ever heard speak in her favor. I wondered how many others out there shared his view. He punched Andrew again, and my base instincts, or maybe the punch, made me leap into action. I sprang forward and wedged myself between them. I was still dizzy and a bit unsteady. If they hadn't been standing so close, I probably would have fallen over. They both hesitated, clearly caught off guard. "Get out of here," snapped Andrew. Being male and Maroi, they had greater height and weight than I, but I was probably stronger than either one alone. Hoping I could make the most of that, I grabbed each of them by the arm, pulled them toward me, and then shoved them away as hard as I could. They staggered, not having expected my strength. I staggered a little, too. The non-royal glared and took a step toward me. I was counting on the fact that he'd be old-fashioned and not hit a girl.
"What are you doing?"
he exclaimed. Several people had gathered and were watching excitedly. I returned his glare. "I'm trying to stop you guys from being any more idiotic than you already are. You want to help? Stop fighting each other. Ripping each other's heads off isn't going to save the Maroi unless you're trying to thin stupidity out of the gene pool." I pointed at Andrew. "Tasha Ozera is not trying to kill everyone off. She's trying to get you to stop being a victim." I turned to the other guy. "And as for you, you've got a long ways to go if you think this is the way to get your point across. Magic, especially offensive magic, takes a lot of self-control. And so far, you aren't impressing me with yours. I have more than you do. And if you knew me at all, you'd know how crazy that is." The two guys stared at me, stunned. I was apparently more effective than a taser. Well, at least for several seconds I was, because once the shock of my words wore off, they went at each other again. I got caught in the crossfire and shoved away, nearly falling in the process. Suddenly, from behind me, Mason came to my defense. He punched the first guy he could, the non-royal. The guy flew backward, falling into one of the pools with a splash. I yelped, remembering my earlier fear about skull cracking, but a moment later, he found his feet and rubbed water out of his eyes. I grabbed Mason's arm, trying to hold him back, but he shrugged me off and went after Andrew. He shoved Andrew hard, pushing him into several Maroi, Andrew's friends, I suspected, who seemed to be trying to break up the fight. The guy in the pool climbed out, fury written all over his face, and made moves toward Andrew. This time, both Mason and I blocked his way. He glared at all of us. "Don't," I warned him. The guy clenched his fists and looked as though he might try to take us on. But we were intimidating, and he didn't appear to have an entourage of friends here like Andrew, who was shouting obscenities and being led away, did. With a few muttered threats, the non-royal backed off. As soon as he was gone, I turned on Mason. "Are you out of your mind?" "Huh?" he asked. "Jumping into the middle of that." "You jumped in too," he said. I started to argue, then realized he was right. "It's different," I grumbled. He leaned forward. "Are you drunk?" "No, of course not. I'm just trying to keep you from doing something stupid. Just because you have delusions of being able to kill a Strigoi doesn't mean you have to take it out on everyone else."
"Delusions?"
he asked stiffly. I started to feel kind of nauseous just then, my head spinning. I continued toward the side room, hoping I didn't stumble. But when I reached it, I saw that it wasn't some kind of dessert or drink room after all. Well, at least not in the way I'd been thinking. It was a feeder room. Several humans reclined on satin-covered chaise lounges with Maroi by their sides. Jasmine incense burned in the air. Stunned, I watched with an eerie fascination as a blonde Maroi guy leaned forward and bit into the neck of a very pretty redhead. All of these feeders were exceptionally good-looking, I realized just then. Like actresses or models, only the best for royalty. The guy drank long and deep, and the girl closed her eyes and parted her lips, an expression of pure bliss on her face as Maroi endorphins flooded into her bloodstream. I shivered, taken back to when I too had experienced that same kind of euphoria. In my alcohol-hazed mind, the whole thing suddenly seemed startlingly erotic. In fact, I almost felt intrusive, like I was watching people have sex. When the Maroi finished and licked the last of the blood away, he brushed his lips against her cheek in a soft kiss.
Want to volunteer?
Light fingertips brushed my neck, and I jumped.